Sai Ram from Prashanti Nilayam. Dear listeners, Radio Sai continues its weekly presentation of the talking book version of Mr. Howard Moffat's highly acclaimed book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. The author was among the very early Westerners who came to Satya Sai Baba as a skeptic in 1964, and drawn by his enigma, he stayed for considerable periods of time near him in the next 6 years. During this period, he conducted extensive research and probing investigations into the Sai phenomena. He published his findings as the book that has become a classic of Sai literature, often considered the primer which introduced Sri Satya Sai Baba to millions round the world. This book was first published in 1971. Since then, it has been instrumental in drawing millions of seekers to the loving path of Satya Sai. These readings, dear listeners, are being aired every week, and if you wish to revisit a chapter at any time, you can do so at our website radiosai.org. So dear listeners, welcome now to Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Howard Moffat.
Sai Ram, and welcome to this talking book session of excerpts from Mr. Howard Moffat's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. Truth stands on its own evidence. It does not require any other testimony to prove it true. It is self-effulgent. With those words from Swami Vivekananda, Mr. Howard Moffat begins Chapter 19 entitled, Some Sai Teachings. In the previous session, we heard Mr. Moffat lay down for us the basic essence of Swami's miracles. Today we will hear him chalk out a few of Swami's teachings and their similarities to those of some of the great spiritual leaders the world has known so far.
Christ's Sermon on the Mount, for instance, seemed no doubt to be quite revolutionary to its original hearers and to many people since. But in fact, all its new teachings can be found in the age-old but ageless sacred writings of the East. It seems indeed that all the great spiritual truths man is capable of understanding at his present stage of evolution were given out long ago by the ancient masters of India. Since then, the basic stock of wisdom has been many times revived, restated, revitalized by the great world teachers who have come. Each presents it with different accent, different emphasis, new interpretations, and up-to-date illustrations to suit the age to which he teaches. But a study of the recorded ancient wisdom in the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Puranas, the Shastras shows that all the fundamental truths that can be stated have been stated already in some form or another. This does not mean that the recurrence of new teachers is unnecessary or unimportant. In time, any temple built to truth becomes its sepulchre. Enlightening words between the covers of ancient manuscripts or books are inevitably forgotten or misunderstood or twisted by knavish priests to make a trap for the unwary and ignorant. The ancient wisdom has to be brought out and redressed, re-energized to give it a new interest and living significance. This can only be done by one who really knows not from books, but from his own being. His words will not have the speculative note of the philosophers, but the confident certainty of true knowledge. Sai Baba has many similarities to Christ, not only in the miracles, but in the style of his presentation. In his discourses, he uses an abundance of parables, figures of speech, analogies, and homely illustrations. This is no doubt one of the reasons why he draws the great crowds. Another reason is the authority that sounds through his words. He speaks as one who knows, and he is not afraid to hammer his lessons home, to repeat, to re-emphasize. In this, he demonstrates the fact, as all great teachers have done, that it is not enough for men to hear and know about the truths, they must live them. The knowledge and the action must be done as one. Now I will try to give some little idea of what he teaches. Man is essentially the Atma. He is not the body and must never identify with the body, which is merely a temporary vestment. Even those who agree with this truth intellectually act most of the time as if they were no more than the body. So, Baba is never tired of hammering in this fundamental truth. He says, for instance, "You are the invincible Atma, unaffected by the ups and downs of life. The shadow you cast while trudging along the road falls on dirt and dust, bush and briar, stone and sand, but you are not worried at all, for you walk unscathed. So too, as the Atma substance, you have no reason to be worried over the fate of its shadow, the body." This true self of man is something subtler than water or air or ether, for it must go into the eye in order that you may see, into the hand so that you may hold, into the feet to enable you to walk. The senses themselves are inert materials. The self must operate before they can function. The Atma itself is formless, but it creates the forms it requires. It has created the five sheaths of man. The grossest of these is the Annamaya Kosha, food sheath. More subtle is the Pranamaya Kosha, sheath of vital breath. These two are part of the physical body. Two more sheaths make up the subtle or astral body. These are the Manomaya Kosha, mind sheath, and Vijnanamaya Kosha, sheath of intellect or higher mind. The fifth is Anandamaya Kosha, sheath of bliss, which serves the highest body of man, the casual body, known in Sanskrit as the Karana Sharira. All these components and compartments serve the lord of the castle, the Jivatma, individual spirit. But the lord, fully preoccupied with these instruments of his own creation and the experiences they bring, has forgotten his true identity. Nevertheless, deep within there is the dim echo of a memory. Sometimes he hears it, so that when a call comes from the immortal regions, he responds. As Baba says, man is not a despicable creature born in slime or sin to eke out a drab existence forever. Man is immortal and eternal, so when the call comes from the region of immortality, he responds with his whole heart. He seeks liberation from his bondage to the trivial and the temporary. Everyone craves for this in his heart of hearts, and it is available in only one shop, and that is in the contemplation of the Atma, the highest self, which is the basis of all this appearance.
This discussion raises the question, does liberation come as soon as the body dies?
But liberation is a struggle that stretches over a long period of time. It does not come automatically with death, as some may think. After shedding the physical body, the Atma is still immersed in other vehicles. It still has links with the earth, links of memory and desire, which bring it back into reincarnation again and again. To reach liberation and eternal bliss, man must get rid of all earthly desires and attachments. In one of Baba's graphic similes, he says, man is like rice. Provided the husk is removed, it will not grow. Man's husk is his body of desires. If this is liquidated, he will not reincarnate. Of course, the conquest of earthly desires and attachments is something that calls for long sadhana or spiritual practices. Most of Baba's teaching is aimed directly towards assisting people in this great struggle, and he uses many homely illustrations to help them grasp and remember the basic principles involved. For instance, he says, man's many desires are like the small metal coins he carries about in his pocket. The more he has, the more they weigh him down. But if he can convert them all into one paper note of higher currency, he will not feel any weight. In the same way, if he can convert his many desires into one desire, that is, into the aspiration for union with God, then there will be no weight to pull him down to the earth level. The fact is that every man is a spark of divinity. Every man is potentially God. Not God as we usually think of him, with form, but the formless God, the divine ocean from which comes all existence. Baba states this plainly. If you realize the Atma principle, you become God himself. Each one of you can become God by merging your separate individual souls in the ocean of the universal Atma. God is formless, yet he has form. He is that which lies beyond all forms, yet he creates, maintains and destroys everything that exists. God is really in every form, but in man more than in anything else, and in some men more intensely and completely than in others. A few men in the world's history have been 100% God. The fact is, though, that God, who expresses some aspect and some part of himself as an essence in every form, can actually manifest as God in any chosen shape, be it human, partly human, or otherwise. Also, he can respond to any name. Baba puts it this way: the Lord can be addressed by any name that tastes sweet to your tongue, or pictured in any form that appeals to your sense of wonder and awe. You can sing of him as Muruga, Ganapati, Sharada, Jesus, Maitreyi, Shakti, or you can call on Allah, or the formless, or the master of all forms. It makes no difference at all. He is the beginning, the middle, and the end, the basis, the substance, and the source. But we must never think that the omnipresent God is completely contained in any particular form of our choosing, or answers exclusively to the one traditional name we have been conditioned to worship. He manifests through such limited, finite channels if our worship is sincere, but he is not confined to them. In one sense, God is nearer than our hands and feet. We do not have to search for him out beyond the starry constellations, where the wheeling systems darken and our benumbed conceiving soars. For the loving, merciful God is ever close at hand. He is the very core of our spiritual heart. But particularly, as the doctor is found where the patients gather, and the surgeon in the operation room, states Sri Sai, so the Lord is ever with the suffering and the struggling. Wherever people cry out for God, there God will be.
So if man's true purpose in life is to realize the divinity latent in him, how should he live his life in order to achieve this?
Baba does not teach that the only way to reach the spiritual goal is to go away and live in caves, forest hermitages, or Alden monasteries. It is right for the majority of us to live the ordinary life of the world, but we must not become bond slaves to the world's allurements. A boat, he says, is meant to go into water, but the water must not get into the boat. In the same way, we are meant to be in the world, but the world must not get into us. He adds another illustration. Man must grasp God with the right hand and the world with the left. Gradually, the left will lose its hold. Do not worry about this. It has to be so. That may be why the hand is called left. The world will be left behind, but the right hand must not loosen its grip. Being called right, it is right for it to grip right and hold on. How to do this? We must realize that the great drama of this world in which we are now playing a part is no more than a passing show. We must not identify ourselves with the drama or become attached to its vestures and properties, which we will soon be leaving behind anyway. In other words, we must learn to discriminate between the permanent and the transitory, the substance and the shadow. The shadow is the great illusion that we are our bodies and that the physical world around us is the ultimate and only reality. The way to correct that error is to keep our thoughts and aspirations towards God, our faces towards the divine light. Baba gives this analogy: move forward towards the light and the shadow falls behind. But if you move away from the light, you have to follow your own shadow. Go every moment one step nearer to the Lord, and then the great illusion, the shadow, will fall back and will not delude you at all. Actually, what we all seek is happiness, but through the deluding shadow of our own ignorance, we seek it in the wrong places. Once you turn towards the path of worldly happiness, says Baba, you will be led on and on to greater and greater discontent, competition, pride, jealousy. Just stop for a moment and examine your own experience. Are you happier when you grow richer? Do you find more peace when your wants are satisfied? You will yourself be witness to the truth that an improved standard of living is no guarantee of happiness. When we seek happiness through the pleasures of this world, we always find as much pain as pleasure, as much sorrow as joy. The pairs of opposites, the black and white twins, are ever near to each other. But let them come, the pleasures and the pains, the joys and the sorrows. They are part of the divine leela or play. Beyond them, and in spite of them, we will find a great peace and abiding joy once we turn our faces towards the light and understand that we are a part of the divine substance, the Atma, and that our real existence lies beyond this shadow show on the space-time stage. Baba says, base your action on knowledge, the knowledge that all is one. Let the action be suffused with bhakti, that is to say, humility, love, mercy and non-violence. Let bhakti be filled with knowledge, otherwise it will be as light as a balloon which drifts along any current of air or gust of wind. Mere knowledge will make the heart dry. Bhakti makes it soft with sympathy, and karma gives the hands something to do, something which will sanctify every one of the minutes that have fallen to your lot to live. I once heard Baba talk in other terms of these three lanes to self-realization. He called them the three W's: work, worship, and wisdom. Work, or karma, alone is, he said, the slow passenger train with long stops and some changes at junctions before you reach the end of the journey. But if you add worship, bhakti, to the work, you will have an express coach and get to your destination more quickly and easily. Work and worship together will furthermore develop wisdom, or knowledge of the real. With this, you will then be on a non-stop express train right to your journey's end. So worship while you work, and strive meanwhile for the self-knowledge that will help these two to bring the true wisdom. Speaking of the spiritual books, he says that they are only like maps and guidebooks. Scanning a map or turning over a guidebook will not give you the thrill of the actual visit, nor will it give you a fraction of the knowledge and joy of journey through that land. In fact, he says in another place, you need not read even the scriptures, the Gita or the Upanishads. You will hear a Gita, specially designed for you, if only you call upon the Lord in your own heart. He is there, installed as your own charioteer. So the great scriptures of the world are guidebooks, taking us as far, but only as far as the written word can. The real knowledge must come from our own inner experience. We must ourselves travel to that land that lies within. But it is very difficult, well nigh impossible, to find one's own way through the forests, through life's dense jungle encircling the divine land. So it is by far the best to have a guide who has been there, who from personal experience knows the route. In other words, the surest, easiest, swiftest way to self-realization is to have a spiritual guru, a sadguru who is himself fully self-realized. So, while the other yogic lanes must not be forgotten and must be utilized as required, bhakti is preeminently the lane way for the great journey. Or to change the metaphor, though bhakti is not the only ingredient in the alchemical formula for transmutating man's base elements to spiritual gold, it is the most important ingredient. Baba has often said that for this age, the bhakti marga is the easiest and surest way to the goal, and many great teachers, from Lord Krishna onwards, have said exactly the same thing. Baba uses many stories and similes to point the value of the bhakti marga. Here is one. A bhakta and a jnani were walking through a forest and became very thirsty. They came to a deep well with water far down and the sides overgrown with bush and briar. There was no way of obtaining water. The Gyani overcame the difficulty by expending great psychic force to assume the form of a bird. Then he flew down through the bushes and briars, losing many feathers on the way. On the other hand, the Bhakta yearned for the Lord's grace and called fervently on his name. The Lord hearing and responding, the waters rose to the level of the Bhakta, who was thus able to slake his thirst completely. Sometimes Baba likens God to a magnet and says, remember that the magnet cannot draw to itself a bit of iron that is rusty and covered with dust. You cannot be drawn by God when your mind is laden with the rust of material desires and the dust of sensual craving sits heavily upon it.
Here are the important qualifications to achieve liberation as given by Shirdi Baba to his devotees.
There is on record a story of how a rich man came to Sai Baba when he was in his Shirdi body and asked to be shown the way to God realization. Baba first put the man through several tests and then gave a dissertation on the qualifications necessary before any person can hope to realize God in his lifetime. A number of Baba's disciples were there along with the rich man listening to this dissertation. I have at various times and in various places heard Satya Sai Baba give the same instructions concerning the self-disciplines, training and austerities necessary in order to make progress along the Sai way, which is the Bhakti way as taught by Sai Baba. So I will give the substance of that memorable Shirdi discourse here. In it, Baba elaborated 10 points. 1. The aspirant must realize the absolute triviality and unimportance of the things of this world and of the next. He must in fact feel disgust for the honor, emoluments and other fruits that his action will bring in both this world and also in the one to follow, for his aim is higher than that. 2. He must fully realize that he is in bondage to the lower worlds and have an intense aspiration to get free. He must work earnestly and resolutely to that end and care for nothing else. 3. Our senses have been created with a tendency to move outwards, and so man always looks outside himself. But he who wants self-realization and the immortal life must turn his gaze inwards and look to his inner self. 4. Unless a man has turned away from wrongdoing and composed himself so that his mind is at rest, he cannot gain self-realization even though he has great knowledge. 5. The candidate to the spiritual life must lead a life of truth, penance, insight and right conduct. 6. Two classes of things constantly present themselves to man for acceptance, the good and the pleasant. A would-be disciple has to think and choose between them. The wise person chooses the good, the unwise, through greed and attachment, chooses the pleasant. 7. The aspirant must control his mind and senses. If his mind is unrestrained and senses unmanageable, like wild and vicious horses drawing a chariot, he cannot reach his destination. But when the intellect and enlightened will exercise the control, like the hands of a good driver manipulating the reins expertly to guide the horses steadily along the right road, then the true self, who is the master of the chariot, reaches his journey's end, the supreme abode of the all-pervading God. Sometimes, using another simile, Baba likens the mind to an electric cable. Do not establish contact with the mind. That is as bad as contacting the cable. Watch it from a distance, then only can you derive bliss. That is to say, becoming too closely identified and involved with the mind incapacitates one for seeing the real that lies beyond the mind. 8. As well as controlling the mind, a man must purify it. To do this, he must discharge satisfactorily and at the same time, in a non-attached way, the duties of his station in life, his dharma. He must get rid of the great delusion, I am the body or I am the mind. This will help him to lose egoism, get rid of avarice, and purify the mind of all lower desires. 9. The aspirant must have a guru. The knowledge of the self is so subtle that no one by his own effort could ever hope to attain it. The help of a great teacher who has walked the path himself and attained self-realization is absolutely necessary. There is no difficulty about finding a guru. When the pupil has done all he can in self-inquiry and self-training, the guru will come, either in the body or unseen. Baba sometimes says, if necessary, God himself will come down and be your guru. 10. Last but not least, in fact, the most important of all, is the Lord's grace. When the pupil goes on trying and failing over and over again, when all seems quite hopeless and he fully realizes his own utter helplessness, then the divine grace comes. The light shines, the joy flows through him, the miraculous happens. He takes another step forward on the spiritual way. After the Shirdi dissertation was over, Baba said to the rich man, well, sir, in your pocket there is God in the form of 250 rupees. Please take that out. The man took out his bundle of currency notes and, counting the money, found to his great surprise that there were 25 notes of 10 rupees each. He had not known previously the exact amount of money in his pocket, and so, feeling Baba's omniscience, he fell at the holy feet and asked for blessings. Baba said, roll up your bundle of God. Unless you completely get rid of greed, you will never get the real God. The love of money is a deep whirlpool of pain, full of crocodiles in the form of conceit and jealousy. Greed and God are as poles apart, they are eternally opposed to each other. For a greedy man, there is no peace, contentment, nor steadiness. If there is even a little trace of greed in the mind, all the spiritual endeavors are of no avail. The teachings of a guru are of no use to a man who is full of egoism and who always thinks about the sense objects. Purification of the mind is absolutely necessary. Without it, all spiritual endeavors are nothing but useless show and pomp. It is therefore better for one to take only what he can digest and assimilate. My treasury is full, and I can give anyone what he wants, but I have first to see whether he is qualified to receive what I give. If you listen to me carefully, you will be certainly benefited. Baba knew that the rich man to whom he spoke was mean and greedy. His preliminary tests had demonstrated this fact to all present. Having wealth is not in itself a crime. It is our attitude to the wealth that matters. If we are poor in spirit, that is, unattached to our possessions, understanding that they are held in trust from God and must be used properly, then it does not matter how much or how little we own. The wealthy man, unlike the rich young man who came to Christ and asked for salvation, apparently did not go sorrowfully away. The chronicler states that, on the contrary, after getting Baba's blessings, he left the place quite happy and contented. He, like the others present, had enjoyed the spiritual feast served by Baba, and perhaps he felt some hopes that the insights thus gained would eventually enable him to reduce the size of the camel of his attachments, so that it might pass through the eye of the spiritual needle. In his former incarnation, Sai Baba struggled valiantly to remove the dangerous misunderstanding and conflict between Hindus and Muslims. In this life, he strives constantly to show the basic unity between all religions. Among his devoted disciples are men of all the leading faiths. He shows his approval by materializing appropriate things for each, including, for the Christians, crosses and images of Christ. This is the greatness of the Sanatana Dharma, the eternal spiritual law. This insistence on the oneness behind the apparent multiplicity. The Atma, which it declares it to be the basic truth, does not contradict the doctrines of any faith. God is unlimited by space and time. He is indefinable by names or forms. Speaking of the evils of our day, Baba says, nations are arming wildly and breeding hatred. Man has reduced himself to the status of a wild beast. The spark that arises in the individual mind has spread a worldwide conflagration of hate and greed. This has to be scotched in the individual, the family, the village, the city, the nation, in fact, wherever it raises its head. Man is suffering because he is not aware of the treasure he has in himself. Like a beggar, ignorant of the millions hidden under the floor of his hovel, he is suffering dire misery.
But Swami says that four firemen are capable of putting out this fire. What are they?
Four firemen are capable of putting out the world conflagration. Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema. Nothing else can do it. Satya is truth. It is that intellectual clarity which enables us to see beyond all the shams, falsities, illusions right to the heart of things. Through Satya we know the truth of our own being, of God and of the universe. Dharma is the spiritual law of living. It is the executive power of carrying out Satya, the basic truth, in the circumstances under which we are placed. Sometimes Dharma will demand that we act one way, sometimes the opposite way. But in each case, it will be in accordance with the unalterable, immortal law of spirit. Through Dharma we live the truth. Dharma is Satya in action. Shanti is the great peace that comes to men through Satya and Dharma, through knowing and living the truth. It is that peace that passeth understanding, abiding in the hearts of those who live in the eternal. Prema is the divine love, which in all the great religions is named as the highest expression of God on earth. Christ said that God is love and that we must love our neighbors as ourselves. The Sanatana Dharma gives the reason for this, that through our real selves, the Atma, we are actually one with each other, with all men and with God. Defining this prema, which flows constantly from God and which all men are capable of feeling for one another, Sai Baba says, it is sustained in bad times as well as in good. It is not like the pepper or salt with which you flavor your dishes. It is the very bread and butter, the essential substance itself. It is an unchanging attitude, a desirable bent of the mind, standing steady through joy and grief. And one of the many stories he tells on this theme is about Radha's love. One day Yashoda, the foster mother of Krishna, was searching for the child who had strayed away. She sought almost everywhere in vain and then went to the house of Radha. But Krishna was not there either. Then Radha closed her eyes and meditated on Krishna for a while. And when she called his name, he appeared. Yashoda shed tears of joy that her beloved was found. But after thinking about the incident, she said to Radha, I love Krishna as a mother with some egoism and possessiveness in me because he is my son. Your prema is pure. It has no egoism prompting it, and so it was more effective. Finally, it must be said that Baba's most important teachings and training are given individually through words, hints, directions for action, example, and perhaps most important of all, silent influence. Such spiritual guidance differs for each individual disciple, for it depends on the disciple's temperament, state of progress, and needs at the time. As it is personal and secret, it cannot be extracted and expounded by any observer. I can only say that to some he gives mantras, to some special guidance in meditation, to some yogic practices and austerities. Others receive none of these, but different types of help. Some followers seem at a certain time to be given much leeway, while others have to keep their sails trimmed close to the wind. The many are taught by simple parables and analogies. The few who can understand are told deeper meanings. The underlying theme of all his training is that we must seek God through self-surrender and devotion. The soul, which has completely surrendered itself, blotting out the lower ego, is able to absorb and gain full benefit from the silent, wordless teachings through which the Sadguru radiates. At the same time, Baba often says, "It is all within you. Try to listen inwardly and follow the directions you get." To show the importance of this inner voice, he tells the story of Lord Krishna and Arjuna taking a walk together. Seeing a bird in the sky, Krishna said, "There's a dove." "Yes, a dove," responded Arjuna. "No, I think it's a pigeon." "You're right, it's a pigeon." "Well, now I can see that it looks more like a crow." "Beyond doubt, it is a crow." Krishna laughed and chided Arjuna for agreeing to every suggestion. But Arjuna said, "For me, your words are weightier than the evidence of my own eyes. Whatever you say it is, it is." Here, Lord Krishna represents the divine voice within each one of us. Our physical senses may give us a wrong report, but the inner voice will never do so. The purpose of the outer Sadguru is to help us hear the voice of our inner Guru clearly, surely, and at all times, so that it becomes our infallible guide.
That was quite a heavy dose of wisdom, and we will stop with that in today's session. Till we meet the next time, all the best and Jai Sai Ram. You have been listening to a presentation of excerpts from Mr. Howard Murfitt's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. This book has been published in 1971 by Frederick Miller Limited in London.